Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Max Wilbert. He grew up in Seattle and spent a great deal of his childhood on the Olympic Coast on Macaw Land. And now in his late 20s, he works with an organization called Deep Green Resistance to promote strategic eco-sabotage and work to protect the land. He also serves on the board of directors of a grassroots nonprofit called Fertile Ground Environmental Institute. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here, Derek.
You've been doing, it's hard to believe. I know from your previous, I know from knowing you that you are in your 20s, but it's extraordinary to me how much work you've done for being so young. Actually, it's extraordinary to me for how much work you've done no matter what age you are, but especially for being so young. It's absolutely extraordinary. If anything gives me optimism, it's people like you.
Thanks. That really means a lot coming from someone like you.
Oh, thanks. So, let's talk about Las Vegas and let's talk about water.
Great. So basically, the situation that we're going to talk about today is happening because Las Vegas is running out of water. And I think a lot of people know when they think about Las Vegas, they think about a giant city in the middle of a desert. And before Las Vegas was settled and paved over, basically, there used to be quite a few springs and natural water sources in the area, but those have mostly been destroyed, and the city is ecologically, it's completely based on importation of resources. It's a place where you can't grow any food, and there's also not very much water. So Las Vegas's water source has always been the Colorado River. One of the biggest dams in the world, the Hoover Dam, is located just outside Las Vegas, and the reservoir formed by the Hoover Dam is called Lake Mead. It's one of the largest reservoirs in the country. And Lake Mead is the main water source for Las Vegas. And over the past 15 years or so, the Colorado River Basin has been experiencing a prolonged drought. And climate scientists tell us that this is largely due to global warming. You've got declining snowfall in the Rocky Mountains, and the snow in the Rocky Mountains is most of what melts and makes up the flow of the Colorado River. So because of this, Lake Mead, the reservoir, recently dropped to its lowest level in something like 70 years or more since the reservoir was first filled up in the 1930s after the dam was built. So the city is in a bit of a conundrum. They are already pretty efficient in terms of per capita water use, but they need more, and Lake Mead is only going down. So one of their solutions has been to build a new intake pipe into Lake Mead. There were two previous intakes, so this third one, they're calling it the third straw. And basically, the two other intake pipes, if you can imagine the reservoir, the two other intake pipes were more towards the middle of the reservoir, and as the level of the water has dropped lower and lower and lower, those intakes become, they're in danger of no longer being functional, because the water would just be below them.
So how do we know how deep Lake Mead was at one point and how deep it is now at its deepest? Or at, I mean, how, what's the difference in water level? Is it 2 feet difference as of what it used to be, or is it 20 feet difference? I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't have the relative numbers in front of me, but I do have the sea level measurements in front of me. So at its maximum level in 1983, the surface of Lake Mead was 1,229 feet above sea level. And recently, in the last month or two, it's right around 1,080 feet above sea level.
So it's gone down 140 feet, 150 feet.
Correct, yes. And, of course, Lake Mead is enormous. We're talking about a reservoir that's 120 miles long. It's got something like 500 plus miles of shoreline. So it's an enormous amount of water. We're talking, on the order of trillions of gallons that's been lost or that's been overused from this reservoir. So basically, they're building this third straw to try and get more water out of the bottom of the reservoir. But the other thing that they're trying to do, and that's really what I want to focus on for this interview, is Las Vegas, the water utility for the Las Vegas area, for about 25 years or more, has been looking north towards some of the rural valleys in eastern central Nevada, and basically looking at the possibility of taking all the water from those areas and pumping it through a gigantic pipe down to Las Vegas. So this isn't just a pipe dream for them. Over the past 10 or 15 years, they've been buying up ranches in the area. They've been working to secure water rights. They've been in the courts. They've been filing for the right to do this. They have completed the environmental impact statement process with the BLM for the actual right of way of the pipeline, which would extract the water or pump the water down to Las Vegas. And it's believed that they've spent something like $100 million of taxpayer money already on this project. So it's very much a project that's moving forward, despite the fact that people in the communities in that area are almost unanimously opposed to it.
So why are you telling me this? And the reason I ask that question is because isn't this just business as usual? I mean, water gets stolen from Northern California for Southern California. The Colorado River no longer reaches the ocean because the water's stolen. The Rio Grande doesn't reach the ocean because the water's stolen. The Aral Sea in the former Soviet Union that
right.
has been in many ways dewatered. I mean, isn't this just business as usual, or is it the fact that it's business as usual makes it even worse? I mean, why are you telling me this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is business as usual, and business as usual is an atrocity. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in this project particularly is because it's a stunning example of the hubris and inherent environmental devastation that's built into the fabric of how modern society is built. And thanks to your work and the work of many other people, I have better language to talk about that now. And so the phrase that I use is civilization. And as you've written, when we talk about civilization, we're using an anthropological definition that civilization is a culture that's built around the growth of cities. And when you have a city, that means there are people living in dense enough numbers that they can't survive in that area without going out to other places, taking resources from there, and destroying those areas. So it's a constant process of expansion. And Las Vegas is a terrible example of this. So I'm also really interested in fighting this project. I originally got involved because I was living in Salt Lake City, which is, if there are any listeners in that area, the region that we're talking about is about maybe 6 hours southwest of Salt Lake City. If you were able to drive straight there, there are quite a few mountain ranges in the way, and it's a very remote area, so it's hard to get around there. But I was living in Salt Lake City, and a friend who was living in the area as well picked up the weekly paper and read an article in there. And in the article, some indigenous people were interviewed from the Confederated Tribes of the Goshute Reservation, which is a very small reservation. It's located on the Utah-Nevada border, south of Wendover. I believe that the tribal membership is less than 600. It's a very small nation and a very remote area. And in the article, several members of this community were interviewed about this water extraction project. And what they said was that not only was it threatening to take away their water, it was threatening their entire way of life. They live in a very remote area that, for the most part, is relatively ecologically intact compared to most areas in the United States. And they rely on hunting, fishing, and gathering for much of their sustenance. This is an area that is some of the best wildlife habitat in the entire state of Nevada. There are massive herds of elk, beautiful elk. I was just down in the region a few weeks ago and saw about 25 healthy-looking elk. There's all sorts of other wildlife. And so to me, as somebody who takes very seriously the importance of indigenous rights and respecting the traditions and ways and lands of the first peoples of this place that we live, this was an issue that really called out to me.
And when you say it called out to you, so what are you doing? What is being done to what is being done to oppose this by you or anybody else?
Right. Yeah, well, like I said, this project has been in the works for a couple decades now, and people in the region have definitely taken the lead. So I want to say that first and foremost, I'm not somebody who lives in this area, and by no means can I take credit for, nor do I want to, for any of the great work that's been going on for a long time to fight this project. There's a group called the Great Basin Water Network that formed, that's consists of all local people who formed to fight this project, and they've been involved in court battles for years and years now, relatively successfully to delay and stop this project. In terms of other resistance, there has been a lot of it. The tribes in the region have been a big part of the resistance. They participated in lawsuits. They've gone to all the public comment sessions. They have continually thrown up roadblocks and worked to make it as difficult as possible for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. That's the utility company, or the it's a public utility, for them to do this project. And so we're talking about not only the Goshute Reservation, but also the Ely Shoshone Nation and a couple of other local nations. You also have, like I said, the local people are almost unanimously opposed to this project. So the county government in White Pine County, which is where Ely is the biggest town in that county, they have also been opposed to it. Some of the other local governments have been opposed to it and have been part of lawsuits. I know that the Center for Biological Diversity has been fighting this project on an ongoing basis for years, and they're just getting ready to file another lawsuit. So as far as myself, when I learned about this project, I felt the need to get involved and contribute in some way. So after reading the article, my friend and I, we contacted the leadership of the Goshute tribe, and they ended up requesting that we come out to the reservation. So we drove out there in the winter, and this was in 2012, I believe. We drove out to the reservation, and we spoke in front of the tribal council, and we basically just said, this is who we are, and we're here because we believe in protecting the land, and we believe in standing alongside indigenous communities that are working to fight for their traditions and their ways of life, and we would like to offer our services. So through that process, we made some friends out in the area, we made some connections, and started to do a few more things to help. We held a few events in Salt Lake City. And I don't, you probably know the story of the Owens River Valley in California, right?
Tell me.
Well, basically, I'm not sure what the year was, but back when Los Angeles was looking to expand, and they needed more water, so they were looking up in the Sierra Nevada, and they found a valley, the Owens River Valley, that they wanted to take water from. And so they started to do it. They put in all these wells and canals and pipes. They took out all the water. And what happened was basically an ecological catastrophe. The entire valley collapsed. All the trees died. Most of the plants died. The wildlife went away. And so Owens Valley has sort of become this cautionary tale about the dangers of water extraction. And even today, well, what originally happened was that the Owens Valley became a huge source of air pollution problems, because by taking the water away, they just dried out the whole landscape so much that any time a storm would come along and there'd be heavy winds, it would pick up tons and tons of dust and it would throw it all over the place. And it became a big air quality issue. And for people who live in Salt Lake City, this is something that they should be thinking about as well, because Salt Lake has the worst air quality in the country right now. And the main reasons for that currently are a gigantic copper mine. The largest copper mine in the world is in the valley. That's the number one source of pollution. The number two source of pollution is the oil refineries that are in and around Salt Lake City. There are five of them, I believe. The number three source is the number three source is interstate trucking, because there's two major interstates converge in Salt Lake City. And then the number four source is personal vehicles, which make up less than 20% of the pollution problem. But if this water grab project goes through, an additional source of air pollution in Salt Lake City and the surrounding area will be dust coming from this region, because the prevailing winds blow from this area right across to the Salt Lake Valley. And so that will be a big issue. So I kind of got off track there.
No, that's great. That's great. And I wanted to say that one of the things that I just love about you is the fact that you found yourself disturbed by this and you did something, because so many of us so often will be disturbed by something and we get mad and then we just, you know, get back on Facebook or, you know, go do whatever it is we're going to do. Or we might make a comment on Facebook, but that's the size of it, as opposed to actually doing something. And so that's one of the things that's just great about you. So that's one thing I wanted to say. And the other thing I wanted to say is, so you brought up the ecological devastation of Owens Valley. Tell me what's wrong with taking water away from the area around Ely. I mean, you know, it's just a desert anyway, so who cares, right?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I was just reading something before we started talking about how one of the developers a big group behind this groundwater development project is real estate people and developers and speculators in the Las Vegas area, because there's a lot of land north of Las Vegas and in the suburbs that they want to develop that could be extremely valuable, but they need water. It's worthless without water. And so for the people who are in Las Vegas who are thinking, maybe this project is a good idea, it'll give us more water. The water, for the most part, is not actually going to be for the people of Las Vegas. It's going to be to subsidize developers and corporations. So in that sense, it's a giveaway of public funds. And we're talking about, you know, on the order of $10+ billion that this project could cost. So I'm sorry, I forgot your question now. Could you repeat that?
The question is, so what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this?
Yeah.
What's wrong with taking this water that's obviously not being used?
Right. So beyond the fact that it's a giveaway of public funds, there are a lot of things that are wrong with this project. We're talking about – so I just want to paint a little picture of the area that we're talking about so people know.
I want to say one thing.
Yeah.
I lived for a couple, 3 years in Elko County, which is – I don't know, one or two counties to the north, and it's called Elko County because there used to be such big herds of elk, but I believe the last elk in that county was shot in 1948. That's, it's no longer, it should be Elkless County now. So anyway, it was nice to hear about the elk there. The elk, you know, people don't know this. There used to be elk all over the place in a lot of the, you know, the places that seem really desolate there. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people have this picture in their head of Nevada as being basically a sandy desert that has nothing in it. I know that's what was in my head. I had never visited Nevada before 2012, so that was actually the first time I was in the state, and I was stunned by the beauty and the natural life that I saw there. I've heard that Nevada is very similar to the Tibetan Plateau because both landscapes are very hot in the summer, very cold in the winter, very dry, and are mostly composed of mountain ranges separated by big, broad valleys. So that's the type of terrain we're talking about up here. And Nevada is the driest state in the country, but that doesn't mean it's just a sandy desert. There are some sandy places here and there, especially down south, but this area is actually quite lush. One of the most well-known features in the area of the water grab is Great Basin National Park. And the mountains in Great Basin National Park get up to more than 13,000 feet in elevation. So there's a lot of snow up there. There's a glacier, I believe, on Wheeler Peak. And there's quite a few mountains throughout this whole region that are 11,000 feet or more in elevation. Most of these mountains have large forests on their sides. Great Basin National Park and many other of these areas have the trees? Bristlecone pines. Mm. Those trees that grow to be 5,000 years old or more. And actually the oldest known bristlecone pine was in Great Basin National Park. And that's an area that, if the Southern Nevada Water Authority gets their way, that national park will basically be ringed with wells that would pull all the water out from underneath it. So besides the national park, there's also about 10 wilderness areas in the region that would be affected by this water grab. Most of the land in the whole area is BLM land. It's federally owned land. So that's land that supposedly belongs to the American people. And it's very, very sparsely populated. There are a few ranches here and there, a few small towns, but a lot of these valleys, you can be driving on dirt roads all day and see not a single other car, let alone a house or dwelling of any sort.
When I lived in northeastern Nevada, I would be down in – there were some valleys I would go to, and I would get out of my car, and then I would walk quite a ways, and it would be so quiet that I used to carry a pocket watch, and I would put the pocket watch on the ground, and I would walk 10 or 11 steps away, and it's so quiet that I could still hear the pocket watch ticking, you know, at a distance of 10, 15 feet.
Absolutely.
That's one of the main things. Another thing I want to mention from my time in northeastern Nevada is, yeah, it would be a lot of where I lived was a lot of sagebrush, and then there was sometimes you would be in an area that is a little bit where the terrain has more contour. So like not even a mountain range, but just like some hillocks, and you might go around a corner and all of a sudden you see this, it's almost like an oasis where you're walking along in sagebrush and all of a sudden there are all these cottonwoods because there's a little spring and a little stream coming out there. It was just
absolutely.
You know, I'm a forest person, so I really like the forest here, but I like the desert. But having said that, it was stunning and much more diverse than I would have thought.
Absolutely. Yeah, and a couple of years ago we went to the Goshute Indian Reservation and we visited one of their sacred springs on the reservation. There are a number of springs coming out of the Deep Creek mountain range just east of the place where the people live there. And many, if not all of them, are sacred. And this spring was was just a torrent of water gushing out of this limestone rock outcrop, and it's stunning walking in from what is definitely a sagebrush desert into this little oasis, and all of a sudden there's stinging nettle and there's watercress and there's all these flowering shrubs and there's hummingbirds and a huge diversity of rare plant species and wildlife coming to visit the area to drink. And that particular area, the tribe has been working with the Fish and Wildlife Service to they've created a small pond and started raising Bonneville cutthroat trout, which are a threatened species of fish that they've started raising in these waters there. And so that's one of the many reasons that the tribe is opposed to the water project, is that they worry that many of their sacred springs could dry up and stop flowing completely if the groundwater is taken out. So as far as other impacts, we're talking about basically ecological devastation. If you imagine sticking a straw into a glass of water and sucking on the water, pulling it out, the water drops everywhere. So that's what we're talking about here with these massive wells that they want to put in. It would lower the water table across the whole region. And what that would do is it would pull water away from the roots of many of the plants that are surviving by tapping the groundwater. Those type of plants are called phreatophytes, and includes many of the trees in the region and many of the plants that would no longer be able to survive. So when many of the plants die, that has a cascading impact, because every animal species is completely dependent on the plants. They're the base of the food chain, and really nothing could survive, at least as well. So basically what we're looking at, if not complete ecological collapse, we're looking at a partial collapse that would, across an area of several hundred square miles, would hugely decrease the ability of local life forms of all sorts to survive. And that includes a variety of threatened and endangered species. There are quite a few snail species that live in springs across this region. And because the springs are so isolated from one another, almost every one of those species is endemic to, it only lives in one spring. That's the only place it lives on the whole planet. And so many of those spring snails, as they're called, are endangered species. There's also small fish that live in many of these springs and small creeks. Many riparian species, birds like the southwestern willow flycatcher and the yellow-billed cuckoo would be impacted. And then more common species, but I don't think the fact that they're common means that it's okay to destroy their habitat and their lives, like pronghorn antelope, bighorn sheep, elk, deer. These species would also be affected as well. And this is also an area that's sage grass habitat, and that's obviously a very controversial species that probably should be an endangered species, but they won't list it. And that species is also threatened by this project. So
just as an aside, we can say that they won't list it probably because to do so would affect public lands, ranching, public lands, fracking, public lands, oil and gas exploration in general, et cetera. Just so
right.
We have that on the table.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I know there are a lot of people who are really into horses as well, and there are a lot of wild horses in this area too that would be impacted. So for better or for worse, the horses would be in for it as well. And like I said, this is some of the most important wildlife habitat in the whole state. So it doesn't matter whether you're an indigenous person or a bird watcher or a hunter or even a rancher or somebody who has a farm in the area, they would be negatively impacted by this project. So the opposition is pretty widespread. Believe it or not, the Mormon Church owns a ranch in this area in Spring Valley. They own a large ranch out there. And so they have come out against this project because it would dewater their ranch. So when you've got environmentalists and tribes and ranchers and the Mormon Church fighting a project, then you might think it's a bad idea.
So what is the short-term prognosis for this project? We'll talk about long-term in a minute. I mean, do you think it's going to go through in the short term, or do you think that there will be some victories in slowing it?
There have been some victories in slowing it. It's definitely not pending, any time in the next couple years. The Supreme Court in Nevada just recently dismissed an appeal by the Water Authority, and they actually ordered the so how water law works in Nevada is that you have a state engineer who's basically in charge of the water rights, and they can grant the rights to whoever they want. And basically the job of the state engineer is to give away public waters, and is to give people rights to them. So the state engineer gave the rights to the Water Authority, and recently the Supreme Court of Nevada ruled that they have to go back and do that all again. They have to demonstrate that the project will be sustainable, quote unquote. And of course that means that they can sustainably take the water, not that it will be sustainable for the creatures who live there. So there have been a number of legal victories, but a lot of the people who've been fighting this project for years just feel like they're delaying the inevitable. They feel that maybe they'll be able to keep fighting it again and again, keep stopping it in the court, but the Southern Nevada Water Authority has been relentless and continues to be relentless in working all the kinks out of their plans and just coming back again and again and again. And there is a possibility that some of the Nevada politicians, including the governor and others, may actually work to change some of the laws specifically to allow this project and others like it to go through. So currently you're not allowed to do water mining, which means that if you have water table, that's how high the water is underneath the soil. And currently you're not allowed to do water mining, which means that you can't just keep pumping that out to the point that it's just dropping precipitously all the time. You're not allowed to do that right now. You are allowed to, for example, lower the water table by 50 feet and then keep it at that lower level. So you can legally do a ton of damage already, but there's rumors going around that they're talking about legalizing much worse destruction, where you'd be allowed to just essentially take all the water rapidly out of an area. So short term, the situation looks okay, but that could always change. I mean, this is essentially a situation where the courts have, to this point, been friendly to the opponents of the project. But if you get some different judges in place, or you get a couple decisions that don't go your way, all of a sudden things could be moving pretty quickly. And a lot of the wells are already in the ground. They've drilled test wells throughout the whole region, and we visited them. Basically, these plots of land, maybe 200 feet square, they've been completely, all the life forms have been removed from them. When we visited them, we could smell the Roundup that they had just sprayed throughout the whole area to keep everything dead. And then the big well sticking right out of the top, with a little, ironically, a little solar panel made by BP on the front of the well to power their monitoring instruments.
Well, heck, if it's solar powered, it's sustainable, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, yes, Beyond Petroleum is making those solar panels now, so I think we're saved. but that's a whole nother conversation. But a lot of the opponents believe that these test wells that they've drilled are actually the production wells, that all they'll have to do is to get production going is retrofit the wells, attach them to the pipeline, and they'll be ready to start pumping right away. So for the past 3 years, I don't think I've mentioned this so far, but for the past 3 years, along with some local people, I've helped to organize what we call the Sacred Water Tour of the area. And what that is every Memorial Day weekend, so this just happened about a month ago, or two, three weeks ago now. Every Memorial Day weekend, we've been going out to this region and spending 3 days exploring the area, meeting with local people, visiting some of the important sites throughout the region, and planning and talking about resistance to the project. And I think that is really important because, as you joked earlier, most people do think this is just an empty desert, but when you visit it, you can't help but fall in love with it. And when you love a place, you will fight to defend it. So that's the main reason behind those trips that we do every year.
So what you're saying about how the water authority being relentless, and of course this is what we see whether we're talking about oil drillers or so-called developers or just standard garden variety abusers. You know, it's all
right.
It's all the same. That's one of the ways they keep winning is that they just keep applying pressure. And
right.
I'm thinking of also what David Brower famously said about how all of our losses are permanent and all of our victories are temporary. And also,
right.
Interestingly, what one of the people fighting along with Cromwell against the Royalists back in the English Civil War said that, and he said this much better, basically he said, you know, we can win 100 times and we still have to keep winning, but if they win once, it's all of our heads.
Right.
And it's the same deal, you know, that we win and then they just come back, they modify it, come back and try the same thing. And if they win, then the whole thing's over. And this happens.
Absolutely.
This is something that every activist in the entire world has faced so many times.
Right.
I don't know what I'm asking you to say to that. Anything you want to.
Yeah. Well, one of the people I've been working closely with on this project is Michael Carter, who's a good friend, lives in Moab. And because he lives in Moab, one of the major issues around there is off-road vehicles and four-wheelers. And there's a lot of issues going on where people are punching roads into wilderness areas and destroying or impacting, you know, significant cultural sites and ruins or burial sites or what have you, or impacting sensitive natural areas, endangered species, et cetera. And what he always says is that the only way off-road vehicles are going to be stopped is if fossil fuels are stopped, is if the fuel stops flowing. And I think that's possibly a similar situation here. I think there's a lot more that can be done to fight this project. Next year, we're looking at doing an expanded Sacred Water Tour. We're going to have a big barbecue and invite all the community members out, try and get people together to talk about more issues. But I really think the next big front in this fight is in Las Vegas itself. I think opposing this project is a no-brainer for people who live in Las Vegas because of the issues that they're looking at in terms of hugely increased water bills and basically public subsidies for private developers. But, I mean, ultimately, the reason, I mean, you mentioned in the intro that I'm part of Deep Green Resistance, and the reason that I'm part of a group like that, which advocates for forcibly dismantling the industrial economy of the entire planet, basically bringing the global machine of capitalism to a halt, is because these type of projects are so hard to fight, is because they are relentless, as you say, and they will keep fighting until we take away their ability to fight. And that's one of the main principles of any strategic conflict, is that to win, you have to take away the ability of your opponent to keep fighting. And these type of court battles, all the environmental work that goes on in this country, I think most of it fails that test. And that's not to say it's not great work. That's not to say it's not worthwhile. But as a movement, the environmental movement has not been effective at taking away the ability of our opponents to keep destroying the planet. And so that's why Deep Green Resistance talks about strategic eco-sabotage and resistance of that type to basically stop the flows of fossil fuels, stop the flow of electricity across the continent, stop the flow of goods and commerce completely, in order to give the planet some breathing room so that it can actually live.
So what do you want, if there are people living in, I'm going to ask a couple different questions. If there are people living in Las Vegas, I'm going to ask the same question about three different groups of people. People living in Las Vegas who want to help, what can they do? People living in the Great Basin who want to help, what can they do? And people living elsewhere who want to help, what can they do?
Great. Okay, I'm gonna throw one more thing in before I answer your question.
Great.
I know we're getting tight on time, but
we got 6 or 7 minutes. We got plenty of time.
Okay, great. Well, one thing that I think is really important to point out, and to add to this discussion is to talk about the massacres that happen in this area. Spring Valley is an area that has been inhabited by Goshute Shoshone people. I think you ask many of those people, they won't say that there's actually a difference between their communities. But it's an area that's been inhabited for at least thousands of years. And in the 1800s, there were three massacres of Goshute and Shoshone people in and around the area of this water grab. Two of them happened in the southern part of Spring Valley, just outside Great Basin National Park. And they were pretty bad massacres. In one of them, I believe it was in 1863, more than 350 men, women, and children were killed by the U.S. cavalry. And they were slaughtered, basically. And this was in the context of ongoing conflicts as the settlers, the European settlers, moved in and began to take over the land. But 350 people were killed. And there was another massacre in 1897. And I believe 50 or so people were killed in this massacre. And two little girls survived that massacre. One of them is the great grandmother of one of the indigenous people, Rick, who we work with, who's a good friend, who we work with, in this area and who is fighting against this project. Rick and his mother, Delaine, have been fighting this project for decades. They live right in the area. And so every time when we go out there, we visit the site of these massacres, which is a place called the Swamp Cedars. It's a place that is ecologically unique, and scientists can't really explain how that community of juniper trees lives there. But in the tradition of the Shoshones and Goshutes, those trees started growing on the bones of the people who were killed at that place. So it was a sacred place long before the massacres happened, and now it's both a sacred place and a graveyard and a place of mourning for those people. So I wanted to add that in because I think it's an important component. There are a lot of sacred and important sites throughout this whole region that would be destroyed by this project. And that site, the Swamp Cedars, it's believed would be one of the first places to go if the water grab goes forward, because the water would be pulled out from right underneath those trees and they wouldn't be able to get any water anymore and they'd die. So that site, that was one of the one of the three largest, if not the largest, massacre of indigenous people in the history of the United States, up there with Wounded Knee and Bear River. So I think that's important history for people to know. So back to your question.
It's the same impulse today. I mean, it's nothing but theft and murder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so to get to your question, people in Las Vegas, if they're interested in fighting this project, there's a lot that needs to be done. And really, a lot of it is pretty simple to get started. I think there needs to be a lot of education of people in the Las Vegas area, recruiting, bringing people in who can help organize, who can do simple things like flyering and handing out pamphlets and knocking on doors and talking to people to really generate some grassroots opposition in the community to the project. So if there are people out there who want to talk to me about that, if you just look up Max Wilbert, you'll find me. I think there's one other Max Wilbert in Germany, but he's like 14 or something. So you'll find me. And I would love to talk to anybody about that sort of thing. I would love to work with you to help make that happen. If you live in the broader region, there's a lot that can be done as well. We'd love to have anyone who's interested come out with us next year on Memorial Day weekend to the area. If you follow the Deep Green Resistance Great Basin website, we'll be sharing all the details on there as the date approaches next year. But there's a lot that can be done. There's lawsuits going on. Those lawsuits need help. The Great Basin Water Network needs donations. Center for Biological Diversity needs donations. One thing that helps the lawsuits is when they get people who just go out and enjoy these areas, whether they're bird watching or hunting or hiking or just camping or whatever it is, doing something spiritual, that can really make a difference and strengthen the lawsuits against these projects by bringing in some voices of people who have ties to the area. And we have an email list that I'd love to add you to keep you updated on what's going on here. So there's a lot that can be done. And I would also encourage, as far as people around the world and elsewhere, I would encourage you to do many of those same things if you're interested in this project. But for me, the number one thing is, like we talked about, these type of projects aren't going to stop unless this entire industrial civilization is stopped. These really are just symptoms of a much larger cultural disease that has infected every level of this culture and is driving it to destroy the planet. And I think in order to stop that, we need to dismantle the physical infrastructure of industrial civilization that allows them to destroy the planet. And we also need to dismantle the social systems and the psychological infections that run throughout our culture that facilitate that destruction. And that's obviously a huge process. That's worth, you know, a bunch of interviews in and of itself. But if you don't live in this region, then I would say, you know, look into your local issues, because there are things like this going on all over the world that need to be fought. And overarching, we need to bring down this whole industrial civilization to allow the planet to be free.
Well, thank you so much for all your work, and thank you for saying all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Max Wilbert. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.